Hello again. Welcome to the ESBS podcast. I am Melina Vega de Zeniga. Today we're going to talk about one of the most awaited and controversial RCTs in peripheral arterial disease, the BASIL 3 trial, plain versus drug balloon and stenting in severe ischemia of the leg, with one of the trial's main investigators, Professor Matthew Popplewell. Professor Popplewell is consultant vascular surgeon in Black Country Vascular Network and assistant professor of vascular surgery at the University of Birmingham in the UK. Thank you for being with us today to share the data and the experience of the BASIL 3 trial.
Thank you very much, Melina. Thank you for inviting me onto the podcast. It's a pleasure to discuss this with you today and the listeners of the ESVS podcast.
The results from the trial were first released in the 2024 Charing Cross meeting in London, and they have been very recently published in the British Medical Journal. We share the complete reference in our show notes. This is the first published paper from the trial, but more are to follow, like the health economic analysis. Now let's start with the starting point of the study. Why is this research question relevant and why now?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. The trial concept took place in around 2012, 2013. And at the time, the use of drug-coated technology, particularly paclitaxel in the UK, was quite low in the peripheral arterial disease space, but it was definitely emergent. And we know there's good data from the coronary literature, which is where we've sort of extrapolated this potential benefit of PTX or the drug devices in the lower limb arterial system. In the UK, there was significant uncertainty regarding the benefits at this time. We have a commissioning body called NICE, which is the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, and they make guidelines based on best available evidence, which commissioners use for, you know, allowing us to use various products or recommending these to use various products. And at this particular time, based on the evidence available, NICE didn't recommend the use of these devices in 2012. Following this, they did say that further research was required. So there was a commission call for further research into paclitaxel or drug-coated technology in the peripheral arterial disease space. And that's why we put this trial together and were successful in gaining grant funding from the National Institute of Health Research Health Technology Assessment. We're the first publicly funded randomized controlled trial in this country to compare plain balloon with drug-eluting stents and drug-coated balloons as sort of class effect devices.
Yes, and since then, the use of this technology has spiraled. So this is level A evidence for something that we're doing currently, but we didn't have evidence on.
No, not at the time. And there was some small industry-funded stuff looking at claudicants, sort of, you know, safety-based studies. But obviously now, you know, the evidence base is huge from the peripheral space in terms of the number of studies done and also the number of cohort work that's been done. It's been a huge explosion, really, in 10 years.
Now, the design of the trial is defined as an open-label, three-arm, pragmatic, multi-center, phase 3 superiority trial. What does pragmatic mean in this setting?
It's always difficult with randomized controlled trials because we want to make them scientifically valid as possible, but then they have to also reflect what people are doing on a day-to-day basis. We tried to make the trial as easy as possible for clinicians and investigators to randomize patients. Clinicians had to have equipoise, so they had to have genuine uncertainty between all three of the strategies to treat the patient. They had to agree, firstly, that the patient required an endovascular revascularization, and then they had to be happy to use all three interventions in a randomized setting. This had to be agreed by at least two operators. They could be vascular surgeons, interventional radiologists, and they had to agree that, again, all three treatments were feasible for the patient. In terms of pragmatic, we wanted to, again, replicate what was going on in the real world. So any device could be used as long as it was approved, you know, had a CE mark and was approved for use in the country. And they could use whatever adjunctive technologies that they wanted. Again, vessel preparation wasn't really as big a focus at this time when the patients were recruited. So the use of things like lithotripsy or intravascular ultrasound was, you know, exceedingly low in the country at this time. But they could use other adjunctive procedures if they wanted to. And again, it was just about trying to replicate what goes on a day-to-day basis so that the findings of the trial would be generalizable.
The trial was conducted in 35 UK NHS vascular units with randomization of 481 patients with chronic limb-threatening ischemia who required endovascular femoropopliteal revascularization to plain balloon angioplasty with or without bare metal stenting, or drug-coated balloon angioplasty, again with or without bare metal stenting, or primary drug-eluting stenting, in the period between the 29th of January 2016 and the 31st of August 2021. That is a little over 5.5 years and includes the COVID pandemic period. Inclusion criteria were CLTA patients, like you said, candidates for femoropopliteal with or without infrapopliteal endovascular revascularization, deemed suitable for all three modalities of endovascular techniques by a multidisciplinary team. Exclusion criteria were life expectancy less than 6 months, other femoropopliteal revascularization in the previous 12 months, inability to communicate in English or fulfill health-related quality of life or health economic questionnaires. Doing the math, mean recruitment was 13.7 patients per center overall and 2.7 patients per center per year. Can you please comment on the difficulty in the recruitment? Which of the exclusion criteria was the most limiting for recruitment and how this can impact external validity and, like you said, generalizability of the results?
Yeah, I think there were some quite unique challenges with Basel III that we didn't see in Basel II. And Basel II is actually more difficult to recruit to than this. I think the main thing to say is that the vast majority of patients that were randomized in this trial were randomized before 2019. And the reason for that was not because of COVID, but because of the Katsalmos meta-analysis, which was published. And so we were actually stopped recruiting patients in December 2018, and we were allowed to reopen recruitment in September 2019. So we almost had a year in that 5 years that you quoted where we weren't actually allowed to randomize patients. So the governing body in the UK, the MHRA, basically a organisation which look into the safety of drugs and devices, they actually stopped us from using these in the UK at the time the Katsalmos meta-analysis was published. The Katsalmos meta-analysis basically showed that there was an increased risk of death with those receiving paclitaxel-based devices out to 5 years. But this was mainly in claudicants in industry-funded studies with quite short follow-up. I think since it's been shown that the mortality signal seen in this is not necessarily something that's borne out in bigger cohorts of patients. So we were stopped for almost a year. We were allowed to reopen, mainly because of the uncertainty around whether you could extrapolate the findings of that meta-analysis to CLTI patients. So paclitaxel-based devices were only allowed to be used in the UK in that time in the context of research. I think that was quite difficult on a patient level because the ethical implications of that are quite challenging. I think some clinicians would still not be happy to randomize patients after that because of the uncertainty. And I think it was difficult at the time to explain to patients the findings of that meta-analysis and how the uncertainty around the condition they had would impact on them. And I think that really slowed things down. Obviously, then COVID came where we were stopped in the UK again from randomizing patients. So there was a block on all non-COVID-19 research for around 3 to 4 months after the sort of first wave of the pandemic. And then we were allowed to continue, but recruitment never really picked up after the Katsalmos meta-analysis. So yeah, most patients were randomized pre-2019. And actually the recruitment before all this happened was pretty good. It was much better than what we found in Basel II, because I think a lot of people found it a lot more easy to reach a point of equipoise.
Right. So yeah, the study spans about 5 years, but real recruitment expanded about 2 years, 2.5 years.
Yeah, from around 2016 to 2019, well, December 2018, yeah. So just over 2.5 years, really, the majority of participants.
Okay, thanks for clarifying that. The study, despite that slow recruitment in the second half, did reach sufficient statistical power, didn't it?
Yes, it did. The Basel III sample size calculation was based on a time-to-event analysis. So we were looking at amputation-free survival, which was the primary endpoint for the study. And the sample size was based on observing 291 events. So that's either death or amputation in the cohort. And when we designed the trial, the best available evidence was from Basel I, because as we said previously, this was 2012. So that was really the only evidence we had in the CLTI space that was sort of publicly funded RCT. So I think patients have changed since then. They're now older, sicker, more comorbid. They don't live as long. So the event rate that we found in Basel III, particularly with mortality, was much higher than we anticipated. So that meant we had more events than we were anticipating in the time frame. Also, because of the Katsalmos pause and the COVID pause, we also had a lot longer follow-up than we originally anticipated. So that meant that the patients we had were exposed to the risk of amputation or death for longer. So in fact, although we had less patients, we did see 293 events, which was, you know, two more than the sample size that we required. But because of what I've mentioned, we needed a smaller cohort of patients than anticipated. So in fact, we were slightly overpowered, in inverted commas, if you like, because we had more events than we needed. So I think the debate really is not about power, but about the differences that we look for. So for significance, we're looking at a 90% power at the 2.5% significance level. And we were looking for a 40% relative reduction in amputation-free survival, which equated to an actual reduction of 13% in the primary endpoint. if we wanted to look at event rates much lower than this, so let's say we were looking for a 6 or 7% absolute difference in death or amputation, we probably would have needed a trial of with around 1,500 events, which would have been about 3,000 patients.
Right.
I think the real question is that practically that would have been extremely difficult and it would have taken much, much longer. In summary, we met our statistical power at 90%. We had the number of events that we needed, but our assumptions were not the same as what we experienced in the real world.
Okay. After randomization, adherence to the allocated treatment modality was 79%. Median time to last follow-up was 2.5 years overall and 3.1 years for survivors, with a follow-up index of 0.89. That is, only 11% of the recruited were lost to 24-month follow-up time point. Do these figures impact the statistical power of the study?
As I mentioned in the last question, when we were talking about power, we did actually experience the number of events that we needed to for power, so it didn't impact statistical power. I think the other thing to say is that the sample size calculation and the primary outcome calculation were on an intention to treat basis. The benefit of having an intention to treat basis analysis is that it's less prone to bias. So we effectively randomized patients to a strategy rather than a specific device. So that, again, this is the pragmatic side of the trial. We were trying to replicate real-world practice. So if a clinician had a patient with CLTI in front of them that required femoral popliteal endovascular treatment, we wanted to try and replicate that decision-making process in the clinic. You've got the imaging that says they need endo and you're not sure which of the three to use. That's kind of the situation we wanted to replicate. We did do further sensitivity analyses. So we looked at the per protocol findings and the results were consistent with the primary findings of the trial. So we didn't find any difference in the primary outcome between the three arms. It's unclear why the treatment allocation wasn't higher in terms of adherence. We have looked at that in a bit further detail. The vast majority of the reasons for this was clinician-led decision-making. So, for example, a lot of time, particularly with using drug-eluting stenting, clinician would pre-treat the vessel with plain balloon before deploying the stent. There were times when people had done that and said they were happy with the result, and then they didn't have equipoise. So again, these were similar reasons across both arms, really. It was mainly clinician-led lack of adherence rather than unable to cross the lesion, etc. Because that's, you know, there will be patients in all three groups for that, but not in as high a percentage.
You mentioned the primary outcome. The primary outcome was amputation-free survival, that is, time to first major amputation or death from any cause. And secondary outcomes included the composite components of the primary outcome, plus further major revascularization of the trial leg, major cardiovascular events defined as a new chronic limb-threatening ischemia affecting the non-trial leg, major amputation of the contralateral leg, myocardial infarction, stroke, or transient ischemic attack, and also 30-day mortality and morbidity, relief of ischemic pain, healing of tissue loss, changes in ankle brachial pressure index and or toe brachial pressure index, and health-related quality of life using the EuroQOL 5D short form 12. The choice of these outcomes has been particularly controversial and one of the most criticized aspects of the trial. Why were these endpoints chosen? And after the controversy, why do you think they are still relevant?
I think a lot of the secondary outcomes I don't think are particularly controversial. I think I would expect to see those in most modern randomized control trials with CLTI patients. I think the main controversy was around the selection of amputation-free survival as a primary endpoint. There are multiple reasons why we chose this. So again, remembering that we designed this study in 2012, amputation-free survival was consistent with the other BASIL trials. So BASIL 2 and BASIL 1, that was the primary outcome. So that was one reason why we chose it. We feel that it's still probably the most important outcome to patients and their families and to clinicians as well. It is a little bit crude in terms of just looking at amputation or death. We obviously did look at other secondary outcomes. So, for example, Best CLI, they chose male death as their primary endpoint. We did look at that as a secondary analysis and didn't find a difference in the outcome. I think it's difficult if you're using composite endpoints. You know, the more composites you have, obviously, the less patients you will need in the study, but also it becomes quite difficult to bore out which of those is having the biggest effect. If you look at SWEDPAD, which is going to be published soon, hopefully, SWEDPAD 1, which is focusing mainly on the CLTI patients, looking at similar technology to BASIL 3, their primary outcome is amputation alone rather than a composite. So I think it's fairly consistent with publicly funded work. I think the other thing is in more industry-focused studies, focused on things like TLR, primary patency, primary assisted patency, those things are important to clinicians, but I don't think they're as important to patients. We know that, you know, patency doesn't always necessarily mean good or bad outcome. You know, you can have patients who've had a treatment, they've healed a wound, and then their angioplasty site or stent site is occluded, and they don't have a wound or symptoms anymore after. That does happen. You know, it's difficult because you could argue that lots of different endpoints could have been used, but at the time, that would seem to be the most sensible.
Right. Now, let's move to something else. You mentioned about the difference in patients that we're treating now compared to those one or two decades back. And the baseline characteristics of Basel III patients include 20% of octogenarian patients, 94% of white ethnicity, over 80% current or former smokers, 55% were diabetics, 34% prevalence of chronic kidney disease, 75% of tissue loss, 20% of myocardial infarction, and 15% stroke history. This sounds representative of the very sick and mostly old CLTI population that we're treating now, at least in Europe. But some listeners in other countries might have other patient profiles. What do you think? How generalizable is this study?
As part of Basel II and Basel III, I actually performed some enhanced screening work at the Leeds Centre, which was in Birmingham. And we analysed the outcomes of all comers with CLTI to that Leeds site over the recruitment period for Basel II and Basel III. This work has actually been published in the European Journal of Vascular and Endovascular Surgery. I think it was Editor's Choice article in January 2024, if people want to look at that. Well, the reason we did this work, we used the Basel CRFs to document the demographics, the treatment algorithms and the outcomes of all patients with CLTI that came to that unit in around 480 patients. What we found from that is that the profile of patients in Birmingham actually reflected the majority of patients in the trial. Now, Birmingham is one of the most diverse populations in the UK. If you look at population data, the UK non-white population is around 18%, so that's 1/8. But that's in all age groups. So if you look further into that census data, the proportion of non-white people in the UK gets smaller and smaller as age increases. So over the age of 60, there's much less than 10% of the population are non-white. So it's likely actually that our sample is representative of the UK population in terms of ethnicity. So people in those age groups who get CLTI, it's probably fairly representative. We do know in other countries that this is different. So again, in Best CLI, we've seen their sample was very different and it was more diverse. They had higher rates of end-stage renal disease. Patients were around 10 years younger in terms of their population. What we did also find from the study that we did for the enhanced screening, we call that the Basel Prospective Cohort Study, or Basel PCS for short. We found that if you look at all comers with CLTI, around 2/3 were men, 50% were diabetic, 30% had CKD. So it is likely to be representative of the UK population. You know, other people will have to look at the baseline characteristics from Basel III and the PCS and see how that matches what they treat. And if it does, then findings are likely to be similar. If it doesn't, then it may impact it in ways which we've not measured yet.
The percentage of women in the study sample was 35%. That's 1 out of 3. This is larger than other previous trials. Best CLI, for example, recruited about 28% of women. Do you think Basel III findings are applicable to women, or is this percentage of recruited women still not high enough to be able to generalize the results of this study to women patients?
I think it's a good question because we know that women are underrepresented in vascular trials across the board, not just in PAD space, but in other studies as well. As I mentioned previously, in the prospective cohort study, around 33% of the all comers were women. So 35% probably is an accurate reflection of the population that we saw with the disease. In the prospective cohort study, we have actually looked at women separately in terms of how they presented. Generally, we found that women were older by around 4 years median. They tended to be more frail, so they had a higher prevalence of some comorbidities. However, they were less likely to be diabetic, they were less likely to have tissue loss, and they were also less likely to be offered revascularization. So more women had primary amputation or were managed conservatively, and that may reflect the fact they were older and more frail. If you look at other studies in this space, the largest one I've seen, there was a large German cohort study which looked at 200,000 patients with CLTI across quite a long time frame, and they estimated around 43% of the CLTI population were female. I don't think it's too far away what we should have been aiming for. It's a representative sample of the population in the UK, I feel. If you look at the other trials in this space, so Basel I, the proportion of females was 40%. Basel II, it was only 18%, so that was much lower. And in Bessie Elias, you said it was 28%. So there is a bit of variance, but I think Basel III is fairly consistent with the whole population.
Another interesting aspect of the baseline description is the fact that over 35% of the patients were treated after using ultrasound as the only imaging method, and DSA as a diagnostic method has become fairly residual, less than 10% in this trial. That reflects the changes in clinical practice over time. What do you think of this?
I think there has been a move away from DSA as a primary diagnostic method now. I think most people are making decisions about treatments before the patient gets to the cath lab. I think when I first started, we were doing a lot more diagnostic angiograms and then stopping, discussing the patient in a multidisciplinary format and then deciding on what was the best treatment modality. I think now imaging has improved a lot more. I think a lot more people are using high-quality MR angiogram, which gives you a lot more information on tibial vessels than, say, a CT angiogram would. And I think also people are more familiar with using duplex to assess tibials. From what I see on a day-to-day level, if a patient has a good femoral pulse and they have an ultrasound which confirms that they have a triphasic inflow, and you know that patient isn't going to be suitable for a bypass, so, you know, they don't have a high-quality vein or, you know, they're not fit enough to have surgery, then it seems sensible to proceed to a diagnostic imaging with or without treatment if it's felt necessary at that time. Then you avoid having two procedures. I think the practice of this still does vary a lot in the UK, and it depends on people's provision of imaging. I think one thing to say as well is that it may seem lower because a lot of patients were actually randomized on table in Basel III. So we introduced that after a few months so that patients could be randomized after the DSA. So a patient would go to an early angio suite, they would have their diagnostic run. And then at that point, if the treating physician and another physician in the room had equipoise, then the patient could be randomized on table. So we introduced that to try and increase recruitment into the study. So that may have also impacted on how DSA was used as a diagnostic method.
Okay. About 18% of the patients had received previous revascularization in the trial leg and close to 20% in the contralateral leg, mostly in the vascular on both sides. That reflects the recurrent nature of the disease we are treating, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think many patients were known to us and we're likely to see them again in the future. We know that CLTI patients often don't just have one admission. They often have multiple over many years. And again, we've seen that in the further interventions graph in the study. There's many patients who have lots and lots of further interventions, amputations. If you look at de novo patients in the trial, it's similar to what we've seen in other studies, like in BEST-CLI and Basel I. Most studies, it tends to be around 15%. We did have exclusion criteria based on previous intervention. So one of the exclusions was if you'd had a previous intervention to the target lesion, so in the femoropopliteal segment, that was less than 12 months ago, then you couldn't be randomized into the trial. So if there were recurrent treatments in the trial segment, then they had to be more than 12 months from their previous intervention. I think we're going to see this more and more, you know, the increasing prevalence of diabetes, more complex disease, older and sicker patients, like we've mentioned before. I think, you know, recurrent treatment is going to be more and more common.
Yeah, unfortunately. Next, let's dig into the results of the trial. First, the primary outcome. Major amputation or death from any cause occurred in 66% of patients receiving TOBA, 60% treated with drug-coated balloons, and 58% with drug-eluting stents, with no significant differences between the groups. These figures are driven mostly by death, because if we look at major amputation only, the rates were 14%, 11%, and 16% respectively, again with no significant differences. The median amputation-free survival time was 3.2, 3.5, and 4.3 years in the plain balloon, drug-coated balloon, and drug-eluting stent groups respectively, with a number needed to treat of 24 and 32 at the two-year time point when comparing drug-coated balloons and drug-eluting stents with TOBA respectively. These results were consistent per protocol sensitivity analysis. How can we interpret these findings?
As you mentioned, the findings were consistent with the per protocol analysis. We've only presented significance levels in terms of a p-value for the intention to treat analysis. As you know, this is the best statistical practice. What this means is, based on the assumptions that we made, so we were looking for a 40% relative reduction in amputation or death or a 13% absolute reduction, that we didn't reach significance. If you look at the confidence intervals, this represented possible harm and possible benefit. So the confidence intervals cross one. The per protocol analysis for death and amputation were consistent. But actually, if you look at the confidence intervals, there was much more uncertainty around these estimates. So the confidence intervals were actually wider than the intention to treat analysis. So I think the key really is we can't rule out smaller differences in amputation-free survival. But as previously mentioned, we would have needed a much bigger trial to test this hypothesis and whether such a trial would be feasible or the differences would be clinically meaningful. This is a point of debate.
By the way, a minority of patients survived amputation-free. What is the profile of these patients who survived amputation-free all through the follow-up?
I think that's a really good question. It's not something that we've looked at specifically yet. We have got a lot of further work that is planned. And this is one of the things we will be looking at, trying to look at predictive models to see which patients will benefit the most from various technologies or which patients are likely to do better than those who are not. We also have got access to the pre-randomization angiograms for the majority of people. So again, we'll be able to get some idea from that exactly what kind of patients were treated in the study and which ones are likely to get the most benefit.
Regarding secondary outcomes, there were no significant differences between the groups for any of them, not even for further interventions or major adverse limb events, which includes both major amputation or major reintervention of the trial leg. Isn't the difference there what would have been expected most when comparing the three technologies?
I think that's what our hypothesis was. I think most people would expect that drug-coated technologies would reduce restenosis, so that would reduce the amount of further reinterventions. I think that's most people is why they would consider using these newer technologies. I guess this is why we do randomized control trials, right? What we think we know and what actually comes out of the trial sometimes can be different, and there might be lots of reasons for that. I think my theory, and this is a theory, it's not based on evidence from the study, is that generally the patients are not living long enough with CLTI to get any potential benefit. So you've seen the main driver of outcome in Basel 3 and in Basel 2 was death, not amputation. And as I've already mentioned, this was actually higher than we anticipated and higher than in Basel 1, which we used to make these assumptions. So it may be that because patients are dying, unfortunately, a higher rate than we expect, then they may not be living long enough to get the benefits of less reintervention.
Right, so that's the greatest challenge.
I think so, yeah. I think there's a huge public health problem. You're still seeing patients far too late in their CLTI journey. Medical therapy optimization still isn't as good as we want it to be. Rates of smoking, deprivation, access to healthcare is still a big issue for a lot of patients. So I think there's huge gains to be made there. And then that may start to improve outcomes for people if we can address those.
I agree. Were all these results, primary and secondary outcomes, similar in men and women?
Again, this is something that we haven't looked at in detail yet, but it is going to be subject to further analysis. It's a really interesting question because you look at the literature in CLTI when looking at men and women, some studies say that there are huge differences in outcome. So there's a meta-analysis that suggests that women who receive intervention for CLTI have worse amputation rates, worse survival, but they do tend to be slightly older and sicker, which is consistent with what we've seen in the cohort study. It'll be interesting to see if there is any difference in Basel 3. We did look at it in Basel 2, but the problem is the proportion of women was so small, it was difficult to make any meaningful comparison. But in Basel 3, with a third being women, we should be able to look at that in further detail.
It is an area of great interest, so we'll be looking forward to those results as well. There are a couple of additional results in Table 3 of the paper that have caught my attention. Baseline opiate use was 38%, 55% and 51% for the POBA, DCB and DES patients. That usage went down to 35%, 34% and 24% respectively at 24 months. Now, how can this surprisingly high rate of opiate continuous use after 2 years be explained?
I think you could look at that in a couple of ways, really. I think you could say, well, is it an issue with persistent CLTI? So do patients have persistent wounds? Are there people who've had chronic pain after an amputation? Is there an element of addiction if they've been on opiates for a long time? I think it's difficult to know. I think medical therapy generally is still not what we would class as optimal for all different types of medications. So maybe patients hadn't had their opiates stopped by their treating physicians locally. I don't know. I'm speculating here. I think what is more likely is that other conditions or that patients have, the reasons why they're taking their opiates. The reason I say this is if you look at the pain scores in the Table 3 as well, so particularly the visual analog scale, this was related to pain in the trial leg. This actually halved in all three groups at the same time point. So there was a 50% reduction in limb-based pain at the same time point. So that suggests that the opiate use is probably due to other factors and not necessarily the trial leg. But again, it's association. I can't give you causation for that, unfortunately.
Yeah. Additionally, ankle brachial and toe brachial indexes significantly increased in the three groups at 1 month, but dropped at 1 year to the baseline mean in the case of drug-coated balloons, and again increased at 24 months, probably because of reintervention. In the best CLI trial, there was a significant loss of hemodynamic data when progressing through the follow-up period. How much of this data was available in the BASIL 3 trial at the different time points, and how reliable is this analysis?
In BASIL 2, BASIL 3 and best CLI, hemodynamic data was more difficult to get than we anticipated. It was certainly more difficult and less complete than it was in BASIL 1. I think there has been some recent data that's come out from Alan Davies' group in Imperial in London, who looked specifically at hemodynamic markers in diabetics, and they found that most hemodynamic markers, ABPI and TBPI, are not specific or sensitive enough in the diabetic population. So I think this is one reason. I think people don't find them reliable. We know that over 50% of the patients are diabetic in BASIL 3. So it may be that, you know, there's a lot of patients with incompressible vessels or just didn't have ABPIs that correlated with the level of symptoms. And I think this is why the global vascular guidelines moved away from a definition of CLTI that included hemodynamic markers. I think people are using them less pragmatically. COVID made things more difficult because we weren't doing face-to-face follow-ups as much, particularly in the last 2 years of the trial. So a lot of the follow-up was telephone-based at that stage. So that it did make getting all the hemodynamic markers difficult. So I don't know if we have enough data, particularly at the later time points, to make any meaningful conclusions about hemodynamic markers. But I think generally this reflects pragmatically what's happening on the ground floor, particularly in the UK. I think hemodynamic markers are being used less and less to make a diagnosis, but also in the patient's follow-up. I do use it personally, but I'm an academic and I do a lot of studies, so that kind of reflects my practice. But I think on the ground level, people are using it less and less.
Now, to wrap up the result description in this paper, you mentioned the pain scores.
Yes.
Can you summarize the quality of life findings? You used the questionnaire. What did you find?
We looked at a lot of measures, probably too many in hindsight. I think some of the patients found it a little bit cumbersome, a bit burdensome to do all of the measures that we looked at. I think the ones I would like to focus on where we actually found some difference was the VascuQol, which is a disease-specific tool. So we found in all three groups, there was sustained improvement in the VascuQol scores. So this is based on limb-based symptoms, which I would class as significant. If you looked at the generic quality of life measures that we used, most of them we didn't find much difference. And again, this probably reflects the fact that this is an elderly population with multiple comorbidities, high levels of deprivation, and actually their general quality of life is probably poor with or without CLTI. And again, if you looked at the EQ5D5L index, which is what we use for looking at the cost effectiveness and cost utility analyses as well, although that improved, so the index went from around 0.2 to 0.4, an index of 0.4 is still pretty poor when you consider that an index of 1 is perfect health. So these people generally, you know, have other issues which are probably affecting them more or equally as much as their leg. Just to summarise briefly about their health economics, we did look at cost effectiveness of DCB and DES. So we found that DCB was only 53% likely to be cost effective when compared to PBA, whereas drug-eluting stenting was possibly cost effective compared to plain balloon angioplasty at a rate of around 76%. So if we get a probability that it's cost effective of 80% or more, we would say that's significant. So the 76% probability of improved health-related quality of life with DES was at a higher than accepted willingness to pay threshold in the UK. So we estimate the cost per additional quality of life year was around £40,000. In the UK, our threshold for recommending a treatment is around £20,000 to £30,000. So it wasn't far off being classed as cost effective.
The conclusion of the trial is that neither drug-coated balloon angioplasty or drug-eluting stents confer significant clinical benefit over plain balloon angioplasty in the femoropopliteal segment in patients with chronic limb-threatening ischemia undergoing endovascular femoropopliteal with or without infrapopliteal revascularization. Now, this is a powerful statement. Do you think the results of the trial will affect clinical practice worldwide? And how do you think they will affect the NICE recommendations, which was really at the basis of this trial design?
I think the statement that it's made in the conclusion, as you know, when you're presenting or publishing anything in high impact factor journal, you can only really relate your conclusion and your findings to the primary analysis on the intention to treat basis. So if you're looking at the assumptions we made, the statistical result we found, the confidence intervals that we demonstrated based on the 40% relative reduction or 13% absolute reduction we were looking for, we didn't find statistical significance. So I think the conclusion relates mainly to that. As with any trial, I would urge readers to look at the detail. You know, we say the devil's in the detail, and see how the trial reflects the patients that they see and correlate to their practice. I think Basel III is the first publicly funded trial in this space to compare all three of these modalities. There is more to come. So SWEPAD is due to publish their data hopefully soon. And that will give us an idea of A, how similar the patients are, and B, if the outcomes are any different. There has also been large meta-analyses since being performed by an Australian group who haven't demonstrated any large class effect from paclitaxel-based devices. I think the main thing to say is that we haven't seen an increased mortality with paclitaxel-based devices. So more than 98% of the devices used in Basel III were paclitaxel-based. So again, it calms the fears about the increased risk of mortality, particularly in the CLTI group. There was a trend to a reduction in mortality, in fact, particularly with drug-eluting stents. I think nowadays we have to look at the evidence base as a whole before making a decision. I think it's rare now that a single randomized control trial would solely influence practice unless the results are very, very strong, which is fairly rare. So I think it's an important study. It adds to the evidence base. It's the first publicly funded study. But based on the assumptions that we made, we didn't find a statistical benefit in terms of amputation-free survival for patients with CLTI.
Right. And additional analysis will come out. You mentioned the differences in men and women, different profiles for patients, especially the survivors, the economical studies. Any other additional analysis that you're planning that we could expect to see published soon?
Yeah, we have submitted two further papers. So we've done the full health economic analyses and also the MHRA again, which is the Medicines Drug Agency in the UK that look at devices and safety of drugs. They have asked us to do a combined analysis where we group together the drug-eluting stents and the drug-coated balloons in one group and compare those to PBA alone with a specific focus on mortality. So both of those have been sent to a high impact factor journal for consideration and publication. And they're also going to be presented at Charing Cross Symposium in a couple of weeks' time as a sort of podium first. So those are sort of ready to go. In terms of the Basel III and Basel II, I've taken over from Andrew Bradbury now as a chief investigator following his retirement. So I've drawn up with Andrew and also one of our head statisticians a publication plan for the next 5 years. So we have got lots of further analyses to come on both trials. So watch this space for those.
Oh, we'll be looking out for them and hopefully be able to talk about them in future podcasts.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Well, thank you so much for your availability to go through the Basel III trial initial results in detail with our listeners today. It has been an absolute pleasure. And I would like to congratulate you, the co-authors, and all the participants for the landmark series of the Basel trials 1, 2, and 3, which have been key to increase the level of evidence in PAD for the improvement of our clinical practice and the benefit of our patients.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on the podcast today. It's been a real pleasure. It's always nice to be able to discuss the trial in more detail. Thank you to the ESVS for the invitation. It's much appreciated. And I hope to see a lot of the listeners and colleagues at the Charing Cross and other meetings across Europe this year. I'd be more than happy to have a conversation with you about the trial or talk about CLTI research in general. Thank you.
Thank you. And as always, thank you all out there for listening. All the ESVS podcasts are available open access in Spotify, SoundCloud, the Apple Podcast, and the ESVS Library. We will be back soon with more interesting stuff. Have a nice day. Bye for now.
Bye. Thank you, everybody.